You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 17th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Linda Perlstein will be with us. She is the author of Tested, When American Schools Struggles to Make the Grade. She'll be talking to us all things education. What can we do about these evil, evil teachers who have conspired to set themselves up for a life of luxury by going to school and learning how to teach and then ensconcing themselves in the luxurious world of public education as a way, of course, of sucking us all dry of our wealth in bodily fluids. What can we do about them? How can we defeat them? How can we join our brothers like Scott Walker and John Kasich and Schneider in Michigan and Mitch Daniels and all of the Republican Party? How can we join them in destroying these people who so benignly call themselves teachers? We will be talking about that. And, of course, we will be talking about the situation in Japan, in Libya, Bahrain, Wisconsin. Got a crazy story of just what this country is doing in terms of IP. Better watch out, Dorsey, with your streaming that you do. Because apparently we're going to make it legal to phone tap you for streaming. You're going to have to wait, buddy. Don't get all panicked now.
I don't have a phone.
Touche. Touche. You have certainly neutralized the would-be spies in our government. Look, folks, you know, things have been so heavy lately. And horrible. I'm going to start off with this story today. A funny story. We may end up seeing Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, as one of the prominent Republicans running in the race. It depends, you know, because there's a great poll out about the Republican base. I haven't gone through all of it, but one of the things that stuck out was that 69% of Republican base members watch Fox News on a regular basis. And which gives you a sense of who they're, you know, almost all of Fox's audience is our Tea Partiers in the Republican base. And it makes it very clear how that impacts their decision as to who should be president. Tim Pawlenty, not even on their radar yet, but he's working his way through. And he, I guess, was in Iowa. And this is just so hilarious. I couldn't help it. Tim Pawlenty, born and bred in Minnesota. You can imagine what he sounds like, just like those strange people in Wisconsin. Hey, Badgers, hey, how you doing? I can't even do it because I speak the King's English, and I don't have such a twisted accent because I come from Massachusetts, where we look at those weirdos from the Midwest like they should be looked at. Like freaking widows. So anyways, but here's this report from local public radio in Minnesota. This is just so funny. We've earned it, folks. We have earned it. Let's play this.
Last week, St. Paul architect Mike Cipina was getting his daughter ready for school when he heard this on NPR News.
We have the first and only government shutdown in the 150-year history of my state on my watch.
Cipina couldn't believe what he was hearing.
And I thought, wait, is that Pawlenty? And then someone did identify him as Pawlenty, and I didn't understand where the accent came from because he sounded like he was from Arkansas.
I unallotted nearly $3 billion out of the budget by myself, which I think is more unallotments than all of the other governors in the history of the state combined, previous to my time as governor.
Pawlenty, who lives in Eagan, is from the South. South St. Paul, that is, but people there don't talk like this.
Budget, my state, on my watch.
You have a good day. Thanks a lot. Bye. Yes.
NPR News asked a few people at Pro Pharmacy in downtown South St. Paul to listen to part of Pawlenty's Iowa speech. All but one had no idea it was their city's native son speaking. Lois and Bob Simon sure didn't.
He didn't even talk like that when he was governor.
I never heard him talk like that, even on the, not even on the television. What does he sound like?
George Bush.
22-year-old Allie Deenan had the same reaction. Do you know who it is?
No.
It's Governor Tim Pawlenty.
Really? Looks like he sounds like he's from the South.
A Washington Post writer also picked up on Pawlenty's accent. Asked about it after a speech last week in New Hampshire, Pawlenty told Minnesota Public Radio News he sometimes doesn't, in his words, use the exact King's English. But no one's talking about grammar here.
You weren't trying to project some kind of folksy thing?
No, and anybody who actually follows me closely or has looked at these speeches over the years know that from time to time I do that, and it wasn't, you know, some sort of strategic decision for that group. I've done it in Minnesota. I've done it in other places, and so it's not some new phenomena.
But Mike Cipina, the architect who contacted NPR News about the way Pawlenty sounded, says he's followed Pawlenty closely for years and never heard him speak like he did in Iowa.
I'm from Eagan, and, you know, I've heard Pawlenty speak a lot since he was a state representative, since he was governor.
Earlier this year at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., Pawlenty used some of the same lines he used in Iowa, but he sounded a lot more like the Tim Pawlenty Minnesotans are familiar with.
I vetoed billions, billions of dollars of tax and spending increases. We had the first government shutdown in my state in the 150-year history of my state.
Again, Pawlenty in Iowa.
We had the first and only government shutdown in the 150-year history of my state on my watch.
Oh, goodness. Oh, that is unbelievable.
This guy could be just vying for, you know, like a job in radio. You know, he could just be, he could take my job. He could, you know, put on the Southern accent. Yeah, we got a government shutdown.
He could replace Glenn Beck.
Sure.
That is fantastic.
Somebody should follow around. If that guy does run for office, someone should take a big recording, follow him around with a boombox, and just be playing, shut down that government! I'm a proud resident, born and raised in Minnesota.
Okay, well, that was helpful. I'll tell you something. I heard that this morning, and I just it made my day. That was so hilarious. So, an update. Let's go. We have some sound on an update on the Fukushima power plant. They're dropping water on it from helicopters outside the building. That, I mean, I have mixed feelings about this. Because that means that there's no roof. Right? I mean, if they're dropping water from helicopters, I'll tell you something. I have read such a wide spectrum of the implications of what a total meltdown is could be. From this, there'll be an explosion. It will only send a plume 500 meters in the air. That's opposed to what happened at Chernobyl, which was like 10 times the height. And with the prevailing weather patterns, really, it will be extremely localized within 30 miles. Worst case scenario of a total meltdown. And in Chernobyl, one of the big problems you had is that people, they didn't know. And so they went and they ate the vegetables. They ate their cows still grazed on the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what caused the literally 25 years worth of whatever it's been now of cancer and ongoing cancer and birth defects and whatnot, ranging to, you know, things should be okay on the west coast of California. So I really, this is just one of those areas where I've read things that sound credible to me on both ends of the spectrum in terms of the worst case scenario. Either way, it sounds horrible. Not to mention just the horribleness that must be existing there. But this is a report from the, what is this, the English-speaking Japanese television.
Yeah, NHK.
NHK.
The Japanese authorities are continuing frantic efforts to stabilize the reactors at Fukushima nuclear plant. Military helicopters have begun spraying water from the air to cool the fuel rods after yesterday's failed attempt due to high radiation levels. There are fears that reactor number 3 may have released radioactive steam due to reported damage to its containment vessel. Indeed, reactors 3 and 4 are causing the greatest concern. Pressure is said to be rising again in number 3, while there are conflicting reports over the water levels in number 4 cooling pool. Plant operator Tokyo Electric Power has said it's seeking to rig an electricity cable and restore the power supply to the plant's cooling systems as soon as possible. With radiation levels higher than normal, Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency is continuing to play down the danger.
Well, that's comforting. Their nuclear regulatory agency is playing down the danger. And my understanding is that the International Atomic Agency, excuse me, is heading there. I mean, people are getting a little concerned. And the U.S. Has issued a warning, sort of a perimeter that is larger than the one the Japanese have. Now, that's not a good sign that everybody's not on the same page here. I mean, one has to wonder what is involved. They just don't want to panic the Japanese people, you know. I would imagine you would want to err on the side of safety. But Evan, you told me that there was a report just as we went on air that they had gotten electricity to these plants. And so
No. They're involved in the last-ditch effort now to try and get. They're running a large high-tension wire towards the plant. It could take a couple days because of how much radiation there is.
So the idea is they want to get basically their water pumps back online so they can do this automatically as opposed to having helicopters drop water on the area.
Ordinarily, the rest of the grid is hooked into these power plants to run these backup systems in case there's a localized failure. That grid went down because of the earthquake and the tsunami, but now enough of it's back up that they're trying to run, you know, a big single dedicated line. Apparently, they're doing everything from telling train operators to run trains at like half schedules and stuff like that so there's just enough electricity in the country.
Apparently there's going to be rolling blackouts tonight or something. Yeah. Just a horrible situation there. And now it's cold there too. I mean, that's the other thing, is that there's going to be no capacity for, there's no electricity for heat. So just a disaster there. And we move, I guess, depending on your perspective, westward to the Middle East. Or eastward from here, westward from Japan, where the situation in Libya is it's getting worse for the rebel forces. And as we speak, the UN Security Council, I believe, is meeting right now to debate not only the imposition of a no-fly zone, but they're talking about going even further. And there's a lot of people who are saying that this is just too late now. The Libyan forces are on their way to Benghazi. They have been battling rebels on the road. This is according to Reuters. On the road to the insurgent stronghold of Benghazi on Thursday, as the United States raised the possibility of airstrikes to stop Muammar Gaddafi's forces. So we're not just talking about now a no-fly zone. They're actually talking about strikes on I don't know if it's on their military personnel or on supply centers. But the international debate on what action to take may have dragged on too long to help the anti-Gaddafi uprising. The ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, said in New York yesterday, the U.S. view is that we need to be prepared to contemplate steps that include, but perhaps go beyond, a no-fly zone. Diplomats at the United Nations told Reuters that the United States, Britain, and France now supported the idea of the Council authorizing military action, such as airstrikes, to protect civilian areas. Hillary Clinton said she wanted a vote no later than today. Russia, China, Germany, India, and other council members are either undecided or have voiced doubts about the proposal for a no-fly zone. Italy, a potential base for military action, ruled out military intervention in the oil-exporting country, has deep ties to Gaddafi because, of course, they get all their, you know, the it's the light crude, which makes the diesel fuel, which is what is hugely important to Italy. That road to Benghazi is sits a town, Abdaya. It is 90 miles south of Benghazi on the Gulf of Sirte. It's unclear who holds that as of this morning, whether it's rebel forces or Gaddafi forces. And just a mess there. The French intellectual, who, of course, it's this entire show is written by French intellectuals. We are we're contractually obligated by our deal with Soros to have this entire show written by French intellectuals. But it was Bernard Lévy. I don't have the exact. Oh, here it is. Bernard Henri Lévy returned from a mission to liaise with the rebel leadership. Said it was already too late for a no-fly zone. We should have done that 8 days ago. Today we have to block the assault marching towards Benghazi, which will launch a bloodbath. There are 1 million people who believe Western promises who said Gaddafi is no longer legitimate. So I don't know what the answer is here. I don't know what the answer is here, but it does not look good for Libyan rebels. And meanwhile, in Bahrain, we have a naval base there, and we have allowed the Saudis to come in, and basically they are just the Bahrain Sunni minority, which controls the government, is shooting Shiite protesters point-blank range. Just a horrible situation that is happening there, obviously overshadowed by the horribleness in Japan. But we will always have Tim Pawlenty for helping us out today and keeping it light. When we come back, we'll be talking to Linda Perlstein on just how evil those teachers are in this country. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Majority Report. Are you fascist about to lose? You fascist about to lose? You fascist about to lose? You're about to lose? You fascist about to lose? You hear that sound, folks? That's the sound of crickets. And that's the way that we show silence in the radio business. And that's what you'll hear if we don't get enough members to keep this show alive. So become a member today at majority.fm. You'll be supporting the show. You'll get 50 minutes of extra content every day. Plus, you'll get some swag and a warm, fuzzy feeling inside with no crickets. Take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery before this war is one you're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, the author of Tested, One American School Struggles to Make the Grade, former writer at the Washington Post, reporter, I should say, has also written op-eds for the Washington Post, Baltimore Sun, New York Times, Salon, The Nation, Family Circle, Girls' Life, which I have, it's been a while since I've read that, and the Columbia Journalism Review. Linda Perlstein, welcome to the program, Linda.
Thanks for having me.
This is an exciting week for me because I actually interviewed your brother yesterday for Ring of Fire Radio. And I know you have two other brothers. I'm hoping to track them down. I'm not sure we're going to talk about
it. Yes, when you do a show about cooking and about rock musicians, my other brothers will come in handy.
All right, fantastic. Let's dive right into this because I am so enraged about how these evil teachers have destroyed our country. I'm beside myself. But I want to talk. There's a couple things I want to talk about. We have heard of the demonization of the teachers' union in this country now, sort of relentlessly for the past year and a half or so. Not just from the typical right wing sources who want to destroy the Department of Education, who think that teachers are indoctrinating our students to believe in things like civil liberties, but even from sort of the center left, as it were. This Waiting for Superman. There was another documentary called The Lottery, which were espousing the panacea that is charter schools and the evil teachers union, which are basically preventing our kids from being educated. Give me a sense of just how accurate that is.
Well, let me start by saying we can no longer know where somebody stands on education by what party they're in. And that's, you pointed that out, and that's important to know. I think that probably creates some challenges for lawmakers who actually have to maybe think about where they stand on the issues. But you're right that the things you're hearing are coming from maybe places that were less predictable than in the past. We can start with charter schools.
Charter schools. Because, I mean, my daughter goes to public school here in New York City. They are opening another charter school in her district at a time where there were three times as many kids applying for this public school than they had room for at the beginning. And class sizes are getting bigger. And I know this charter school is going to take resources away from all of the public schools in this district.
Well, I want to start by clarifying. Charter schools are public schools. So just rhetorically, we have to make sure everyone understands that. They're not bound by some of the same strictures that other public schools are. There are some charter schools that are doing a great job for students. There are some that are not. And so, what advocates are saying is let's give them a chance to if they can be successful, let's give them a chance to do that and not stand in the way.
Right. I mean, I don't think people are saying that charter schools in and of themselves are a bad idea, but isn't the theory behind charter schools that they are experimental and they essentially are supposed to introduce new ideas into the bloodstream,
That's initially, when they were started decades ago back in actually Minnesota. I mean, that was the initial idea, like let them be laboratories for innovation. And, to some degree, some of them are doing new things. Now, the idea that innovation would then spread its way into the traditional schools really has never happened by any stretch of the imagination. So, like, in that sense, they're no longer doing what the original innovators sort of hoped they would do, which is to spur innovation everywhere. I think that the charters that are successful, that people like Arne Duncan, and Bill Gates really like, look pretty similar to each other. They do things slightly differently, but they often rely on a longer school day and year and what's called a no-excuses culture, really rigorous emphasis on data in instruction and, tracking student data and keeping track of where everyone is and setting high expectations. There are traditional public schools that do that as well, but certainly not every school. And so,
well, let me ask you this.
If that's appealing to people.
The data that I have seen suggests that charter schools on whole are no more successful in terms of educating our children on whole than public schools on whole are.
And yet some are much more successful and some are less successful. So in a way, I mean, I'm very familiar with the research, and it's almost sort of like the wrong question, which is charters as a whole, are they better or worse? Why are some better and why are some worse? And that's the things that we need to be really asking and using that to drive, you know, approval of charters, regulation of charters once they're in existence, you know. Should you get to stay alive just sort of indefinitely because it's such a hard process to shut it down in some states? I mean, that's really the more important question than, you know, there's conflicting research about, but the studies are all fairly limited in what they say and who they say it about. And that's why we can't really, at the end of the day, say they work or they don't work. It really depends on the school and the place and a lot of other factors.
Isn't that the case also with public schools?
Yeah, mm-hmm, of course.
Okay, so, to the extent that we can say anything about charter schools, it is that they're not too dissimilar than non-charter schools.
I think individual schools can be very dissimilar, but if you're talking about sort of, you know, the whole of the results, I think that's fair to say.
Now, so tell me about the problems with teachers' unions. I mean, I am not someone who believes that all unions or that everything about unions is perfect. Far from it. Just as the exact same thing I would say about let me put it this way. I've had far more problems with the corporations I've worked for than I have for the unions that I've been a part of. But I'm sure there are problems in every entity. But tell me about what are some of the issues with teacher unions.
Well, so I want to start by saying that I think in this conversation, and I'm sure it's like this in other sectors as well, unions are sort of taken as a proxy for all teachers. And I'm not sure that's always completely reflective of where things stand. But in this case, it's, you know, it's how the conversation has been set up. So that said, I think the criticism that teachers' unions have stood in the way of several reforms is a fair one. You know, the biggest unions, the only two, AFT and the NEA, are different in their governance, and so they do this to differing degrees, but pretty reflexively have seen their jobs to, you know, guarantee certain working conditions for their workers and to maximize pay and not directly to increase student achievement. So that's sort of the basis on which they're criticized, which is that their raison d'etre is not necessarily to increase student achievement, even if that's, you know, even if that's what drives many of their members.
Right. Okay, so fair enough. So let's talk about this this notion of first, and of course there's got to be somebody who's advocating for teachers to get better pay and better working conditions, and obviously it's not necessarily going to be management in this case or the administrations of these schools. But let's talk about this idea of last hired, first fired. This is a very, you know, people say that we should be able to evaluate teachers based on the quality of their teaching, but that's a very hard thing to quantify, isn't it?
Well, this is a tricky question. Was it hard to quantify? It depends who you ask. I mean, there are some people who say, actually, it's not that hard to quantify. We have the tools to do it. We're just not doing it. Then there are people who
Well, tell me, what are those tools?
Well, we do have information about how students do on their assessments every year, and there's certainly a lot of people who are saying, you know, that should be make up the bulk of how we evaluate.
So standardized testing. I mean, one way we could measure teachers is by
standardized test results of their students, and, you know, taking into account how they did last year, Compare that to how they do this year, taking into consideration various factors like student income level and things like this. Can we derive a measure that does some part in setting a bar for where the students should be and where they are and what the teacher's role in that is?
Okay. I mean,
there's an incredible amount of, sort of practical complications of doing this.
Well,
but
that's my point. If we're going to measure teacher effectiveness based upon the performance of their students in standardized tests, I mean, don't we have a problem with that? Because then what you have is you're incentivizing these teachers to teach to the test and to spend their time rather than sort of fully educating the student. We're encouraging them to teach the kids how to take a standardized test.
And certainly there are teachers who can improve their students' performance on the test and do everything else you want a teacher to do. And then there are teachers who will focus so narrowly on the test and how it's presented that they won't do the rest. But here's the problem, and I don't think anyone would disagree with it now. We have really no good way of assessing teachers now. What happens is principals come in a couple times a year. They watch a staged lesson. They almost always say that everyone is doing fine. And, no matter how you slice it, we know that not everyone is doing fine. And so, to some degree, we do have a system that theoretically principals could identify teachers when they're weak. But somehow the system is set up that they feel like it's not worth it to do that, that if they identify someone as weak, the hoops they have to go through to sort of document and get that teacher out, are so high. Now, that doesn't mean to say that some principals don't do a good job of making those distinctions. I mean, there certainly are. But somehow, systemically, we have a problem when the incentive is not to be honest about how your teachers are doing. To me, you asked before about the unions. Well, I work in a profession where I'm judged to some degree, or to actually the greatest degree, by the judgment of my supervisors. And I actually don't have a problem with that, saying we have managers in their jobs, and to some degree we should let them tell us who's doing well and who's not. That's one thing that the unions have always fought, saying that we can't rely on the subjective judgment of principals. And so at the end of the day, what else is there? How about we try test scores? I mean, if you block out everything else, people are going to be looking for something. And I think that's what happens here.
Well, I mean, what is the solution? Because, yes, we have, everyone who's listening to this program is judged by their supervisors, but their supervisors have a fairly stringent, they have basically two things to work off of. How productive is this person? In other words, are they bringing in more money? More often than not, than I'm paying them, or to a certain extent, what is the do I like this person? And
that's exactly that's exactly what you can do in education. You can develop a system that uses some degree of quantifiable outcomes, right? I mean, whether it's survey results, test scores. I mean, no matter what you think of tests, I mean, I think it's hard pressed to say they tell you. I'd be hard pressed to say they tell you nothing. They tell you something. So, that should be one factor. I think, administrators' judgment should be another factor. The key is to develop a sophisticated system to do this, and we're not.
Whose responsibility is to develop that?
Well, right now it's done at the school district level and, state level. It's not, the federal government has, is trying to press for, incentivize, as they say, certain ways of approaching this. But they don't set the policy at the end of the day by which teachers are evaluated.
I mean, so isn't that the problem? I mean, isn't the problem that because we're leaving the creation of these standards on how to measure the quality of a teacher on a district by district or a state by state or a municipality by municipality level, that there is a massive opportunity for the system not to work in large gaps. And so,
but isn't there also a massive opportunity for someone somewhere to come up with something that's a really good idea?
Well, sure. I mean, yes. But that doesn't, but like you say, I mean, we haven't, the charter system, which was set up to do that, has not performed that function at all.
Well, I mean, here's the difference. In the charter system, if they think a teacher is not doing a good job, it's definitely easier for them to get rid of that person. So some people will say that means it works, and some people will say, well, if they don't have the same due process as a teacher in a different school, then that doesn't work. You know, I think it depends where you stand on that particular issue to, you know, determine whether you think that.
Well, but all charter schools have that freedom. And yet, we don't see a marked difference overall. I mean, because that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking
about... That's just one, you know, you're talking about just one variable.
Well, exactly. But I mean...
A complicated ecosystem.
Right. So, I mean, I guess but the one thing that I think we can glean from that is that the notion that we cannot fire teachers easily in the public schools is obviously not the problem. It may be one of a myriad of problems. But it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the problem, or we would see charter schools, on balance, far more successful than public schools, and we just don't have the data to support that.
I do agree that it's, you know, it's very reductive to, you know, to imply that all that matters is, you know, the teacher. And there are a lot of systemic elements here that are important too that aren't getting as much conversation because we're so busy talking about how are we going to evaluate teachers and how are we going to get rid of teachers and on a quieter level, not nearly as loudly, how are we going to improve teachers? Because really, no matter what kind of system you put in place, most of the people who are here this year are still going to be here next year. And the most important thing is to help them do a good job.
Right. I mean, I
which
think you know,
is sort
I think,
of lost in this conversation.
Right. No, of course. I mean, I think we don't. We're not providing the resources that teachers need. Frankly, we don't. You know, I mean, this is obviously a profession that's hard to keep people in there. The average teacher leaves after 5 years, is my understanding. Let me just turn to one more quick question for you. This race to the top that is coming out of the Obama administration, how different is it from something like Leave No Child Left Behind?
You know, I was really surprised because if you had asked me when Arne Duncan, you know, they had all this stimulus money, I think it was, you know, well, it was hundreds, you know, it was... Hundreds, there was just a lot of money, and then they took this very small slice of it and said, we're going to try to get people to adopt these very specific types of reform with this tiny amount of money compared to all this money that we're giving out in the stimulus. And I said, you know, it's not going to happen. They're not going to change. All these states aren't going to change their behavior because of this small pot of money, which was barely $5 billion. And, you know, I had to eat my words because states were really racing to, well, what was being called the top. And so, it, you know, it wasn't the difference. These are two very different things. I mean, one was a law. No Child Left Behind was a law that had, you know, said, you know, these are the students you have to assess, and this is what the results are going to mean. And, you know, Race to the Top was, in essence, a grant program saying, if you choose to do these sorts of things, we may give you some, you know, we may give you some money.
I guess I'm more interested in what is the top in this instance? I mean, like, you know, for instance, I know that, you know, kids in New York public schools, if they come into, just as an example, I mean, this just came up the other day. If they come into school and the nurse checks them for lice and only sees eggs in the kids' heads, they have the kids stay in there until they actually have lice because they're afraid of attendance rates and losing funding.
Right.
So kids stay in there with lice. Everybody keeps getting lice over and over again. The whole thing lasts a lot longer than it should. Kids miss more school in the end than they probably should have. But they do this because they want to bet that they can maybe keep attendance rates to a certain point because that affects their funding. Now,
but I'm going to push back a little here because, you know, at the end of the day, No Child Left Behind does not say, like, keep kids in school if they have lice. Like, this is a decision of individual people in school districts and schools. I mean, these are people, maybe this comes from the superintendent, maybe it comes from
The system is set up in such a way that it incentivizes this behavior.
Right. I mean, we have all sorts of, you know, we have all sorts of things that create perverse incentives. And I do agree that it takes some sort of boldness to do the right thing in the face of perverse incentives. But I want to be clear what's happening here, which is, you know, and I've seen it. I've seen bad teaching and people blaming, you know, No Child Left Behind because they didn't teach science. You know, maybe it's easy for me to say because I don't run a school, but no matter what, I'm still going to be teaching science to my kids, even if it's not, you know, the test results aren't going to be required by the state. So I feel like we have to actually sort of spread the responsibility around here a bit and say, if you're keeping sick kids in school, you're not really doing them a favor.
Right. All right. Well, listen, we are out of time, but I want to thank you very much. Linda Perlstein, author of Tested, One American School Struggles to Make the Grade. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay. We got to take a break, folks. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. We're done. Wrong music. All right, let's try this again. We're going to take a break, and you can catch us on the flip side. I will talk about that IP spying tomorrow because it's an important story. And we'll get into some more of these polls. Tomorrow's Casual Friday, so we'll have plenty of time to talk about it. Beautiful day out today in New York City. Sun is shining, 60 degrees, just anticipating the enormous heat problems we're going to have in the studio in months. Once the weather drops, or I say the temperature goes above 45, we've got a real problem. All right, we got a lot of IMs. People, you know, education always creates a lot of fervor. And I don't know. I was a little frustrated with that interview. There's a lot of nuance, I understand, in this. A lot of nuance. But, I mean, I get it's a gray area. Difference in gray and completely misty. We're gonna take a break. We'll be right back after this.